Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jimmy Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. Any movement can look back at a few pivotal moments, public or private, where big strides were made. For the Tea Party in public, there's Rick Santelli's rant on CNBC in February 2009, which many saw as kicking off the movement. There's the April 15th rallies around the country that same year. And, of course, there were the slate of Tea Party candidates elected to Congress in fall 2010. But one important behind-the-scenes moment was when longtime South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint began to back the Tea Party. He was one of the movement's earliest supporters within the Washington establishment, and his endorsements and financial support were seen as crucial to electing many of those first-time Tea Party candidates to office. Jim DeMint tells the story of the Tea Party in his new book, The Great American Awakening, 2 years that changed America, Washington, and me. We'll talk about the birth of the Tea Party and the role it's playing in the 2012 GOP nomination contest, and a little about politics today with Jim DeMint, who joins me now. Welcome to WNYC, Senator.
Jamie, thanks for having me. It's good to be with you, and there's a lot to talk about, and the book is just a part of it. But as you mentioned, it includes not just the birth of the Tea Party, but how that movement, as well as other citizen activism things such as town halls and rallies in Washington, how that changed Washington, and it actually had a big impact on me, too.
Well, I'm going to get through this whole interview, Senator, without calling you a kingmaker.
Yeah, please.
Which, for some reason, every one of my colleagues seems the need to call you when they interview you. But I'm going to try and get through the whole thing without using that word once. Is that all
Thank
right with you?
No, I would appreciate it, because we don't need any more kings in Washington, and I'm not a kingmaker.
All right. Well, you write about President Obama being elected on, quote, false promises. Are you saying, Senator, that you once had high hopes for President Obama?
Well, Barack Obama and I came into the Senate the same year, and I can't say that we were close friends, but certainly we were cordial. We had a good relationship. And I think the way he ran his campaign was what I would consider relatively conservative. You know, he was going to go through the budget and cut things line by line, cut the deficit in half. He wanted to have tax cuts. And so I think his optimism, and I think just charisma, encouraged a lot of people. Obviously, I would have preferred a Republican be elected, but as I say in the book, after the inauguration, he gave a great speech. I think there was a spirit of hopefulness here in Washington, but that quickly came to an end. And I'm not blaming it all on Obama. Anyone who reads the book will find out I'm just as critical of Republicans. Most of the book is about my fight with Republicans. But in some of these concerns that we saw bubble up after Obama took office really began in the Bush administration with the bailouts and other things that grew spending and grew government. So one of the things Barack Obama inherited was this latent growing concern about the growth of government, the spending, and the debt. But by the first few months Obama's administration, when he pushed through this trillion-dollar stimulus plan and some of his executive orders that suggested that this was more politics as usual, I think that led to an outburst, not just from Santelli, but as we saw in April 15th, the first tax day rallies. And from there, I just chronicle the 2 years of what happened around the country and what was happening inside behind closed doors in Washington as we saw this explosion of citizen activism.
Well, it is a tough nut to crack, but we're going to try and crack it. Let's dive in a little bit. Yesterday, right here on the show, Brian spoke with longtime New York Times liberal columnist Frank Rich. He's now at New York Magazine. And his first piece there is about the enormous level of frustration he sees among average Americans with how President Obama has cozied up to big banks. Now, last month, liberal economist Joe Stiglitz was on the show, and this is what he had to say about the Tea Party.
They looked at what happened to the financial crisis, and there was no sense of accountability. So what they have said is, we can't trust government because government is part of the problem because it is run by that 1%. So we had a crisis, and who got bailed out? The big banks. Who was left in the lurch? The millions of Americans who are losing their homes. 7 million have already lost their homes.
Now, Senator, is it possible that there is a Frank Rich, Joe Stiglitz, Jim DeMint Tea Party nexus?
Well, it's surprising you ask the question, because one of the things I've found is when I'm at Tea Parties, there is a very diverse group. I mean, you've got conservatives, you have liberals, and you have liberals finding more common ground with libertarians around just the need for individuals to be more accountable. They're frustrated with the overreach of government. And so there's a lot of new partnerships developing because of this concern about fiscal issues and debt, because every American with common sense understands that we can't keep spending more than we're borrowing. And despite which party is in office, we've seen the debt grow. In the last few years, it's really grown exponentially. And the budgets that have been presented for the next 10 years suggest we're probably going to even double that debt again. Americans know that there's going to be a point of reckoning, and they want to try to stop it. And it really is uniting Americans. Now, it's polarizing us in Washington, because there are two different philosophies. There's, you know, one group that believes that the centralization of power is important and collectivist policies are going to solve our problems. Others are increasingly believing we need to return to more decentralized political power, more individualism. And that's the great divide here.
And that's the divide we've had pretty much from the beginning, the founding of our country. I want to ask you, of course, about the debt, and you know I'm going to say debt ceiling in just a few minutes, but I have to ask you a little bit more about the Tea Party itself. How exactly should we view the Tea Party as a political organization? Is it still a pure grassroots movement? Has it morphed into a political party yet? And are you worried that a level of influence and money has started to compromise the values of the movement as you see them?
Well, for the most part, it is still very much a grassroots, some people call it leaderless organization, but the fact is there are thousands of leaders. I mean, I see Tea Party groups that have 10 people in them, and that they're just wanting to affect local politics, make calls to congressmen. But there are, I mean, some instances around the country where they're trying to be more of a force, more organized, more formal. And to some degree, whenever you do that, you create a hierarchy and a structure that takes the spontaneity out of it. I don't see any move for it to become a political party, although you've had a few people sign up to run as Tea Party candidates. For the most part, they have not been Tea Party people. It's just been more of a strategy to divide the conservative vote.
But you do have the support. The Tea Party does have PACs, the Koch brothers, and I know we have listeners right now thinking to themselves that it has just become another big money government movement.
It's too divided. There may be sponsors. The Koch brothers have sponsored the Americans for Prosperity grassroots group for years, and they perhaps interact with some of the Tea Parties, but I think those who've tried to figure out the Tea Parties have often said it's some kind of, you know, Republican conspiracy or big money, and it is a very fragmented, spontaneous group and continues to be. And what a lot of people are wondering, including myself, is the energy still there? Mm-hmm. Will it build or will it die out? And what we're trying to find out right now with this debt ceiling issue is we now have hundreds of Tea Party groups involved with us, as well as almost 100 conservative organizations sponsoring this cut, cap, balance pledge that we're pushing right now to get Americans to sign, to get candidates to sign, to get members of Congress to sign. I mean, what it says is we're going to oppose any increase in the debt limit unless we get three things. It's to cut spending significantly this year, cap spending over a 10-year period, and pass a balanced budget amendment, send it to the states so Americans can decide whether or not we should balance our budget, you know, sometimes 6 or 8 years out. These are the things that are we're trying to get particularly Republicans, hopefully some Democrats, to commit to, that we're not going to go through another debt ceiling without some permanent structural reforms. This is the 10th time in 10 years that we will be raising the debt limit, the fourth time in the Obama administration. The purpose of the debt limit law is to keep us from borrowing more than we can pay back.
Let's talk a little bit about the debt limit. Now, as you say, you've been asking candidates to sign the cut, cap, and balance pledge. Michelle Bachmann, who is widely seen as the Tea Party candidate in the race, hasn't signed the pledge. Why not? Do you know?
I've talked with Michelle. She agrees with everything in it, but she would like to add some things, particularly the repeal of Obamacare. But the point of the pledge is not to present a conservative or Tea Party agenda, but just to address this particular issue that is right in front of our face, which is the debt ceiling. And I'm convinced that we've got to get more of a consensus of Americans around this idea. Because if Republicans give in to another bad deal, as we did a few months ago, I think it's really going to discourage those people who have gotten more active in the political process. So I have said I don't have many litmus tests for our presidential candidates, but one of them is that they need to sign this pledge. And some people make fun of pledges, but frankly, we were able to get rid of earmarks in Congress by getting enough names on a pledge that showed our leadership that we could win when we had a vote. And once that happened, the things changed and we were able to get that ban passed. And so I'm convinced once we show that we're going to fight and stand for something, then it gives us more leverage in negotiations.
Last night, Senator, you told my friend and colleague Andrew Napolitano that Republicans should maintain their hardline position on the debt ceiling debate, even if it results in, quote, serious disruptions to the economy. How serious a disruption are you willing to entertain? And for you, how close is too close to default?
Well, we're not going to default, first of all. I mean, Secretary Geithner, I believe, has been irresponsible in suggesting we would, because if we never raise the debt ceiling, we're going to have enough revenue to pay our debts, to pay Social Security, to pay our troops. But what we talk about is disruptive, and it would be. We've made a lot of commitments to contractors, to government employees, and if we start delaying those payments, it is disruptive. But we don't have a good decision here, because if we just raise the debt limit again without serious permanent structural reform, I think the disruption economically into the value of our dollar could actually be worse as our creditors, as the rating agencies, as other countries look at us and realize we're not serious about dealing with our debt. That's going to be or cause more long-term damage than us dealing with in a few short weeks a stare down of whether or not we're going to raise this debt limit with or without a balanced budget. So I don't obviously want any disruption, and I want to make it clear that we're not going to default on our loans. But I think it's a matter that we have to take a stand at some point to get permanent structural reform, or this Congress is going to spend our country into bankruptcy. There's no question in my mind that that's going to happen. So I think now is the time to do it. That's what cut, cap, and balance is all about. We don't have to have disruption, because I believe if we pass this cut, cap, balance bill and give the president his debt limit increase, then it's really up to him whether or not he wants to take the country through any disruption.
According to an NPR report, you call it mere disruption, it would be $23 billion in Social Security payments that are supposed to go out on August 3rd. The U.S. only collects $12 billion in taxes per day. And I do hear your language calling Secretary Geithner irresponsible, but of course you're in receipt of his letter, which calls your approach, quote, deeply irresponsible, a departure from the commitments by presidents of both parties throughout American history to honor all commitments by our nation. That's quoting Secretary Geithner. What do you say in response to that, Senator?
Well, the letter that a number of us sent Secretary Geithner was suggesting to him that in the event that the debt limit was not raised, that he needed to make contingency plans to pay our bills and to meet our primary responsibilities. In other words, to prioritize our payments, as sometimes families and businesses have to do when cash flow comes up short. So we were not calling for disruption, but we were suggesting that he not talk to the world markets about not paying our debts, but instead showing that we were going to deal with this one way or another. I hope we can resolve the problem, but frankly, I don't think, based on my 12 years in the House and the Senate, that the Democrats are going to willingly give us any significant structural reform that are not just smoke and mirrors, unless we actually hold the line with them and say, folks, hey, we'll give you your debt limit, but we have to have a balanced budget at the end of the day, or at least let the states decide. We shouldn't be afraid to let the American people in the states vote on whether or not we should have a balanced budget. This is something that would not occur for 6 to 8 years because it would take 2 or 3 years to ratify a constitutional amendment. After that, 5 years for it to take effect. So we have plenty of time to transition in an orderly way away from some of the non-essential government programs so that we can keep our promises to seniors and defend our country.
Now, Senator, in all fairness, we are supposed to be talking about your book.
Yeah, we are. Oh, that's right.
Which is called 2 Years That Changed America, Washington, and Me. So how exactly have you changed? What about these 2 years have changed you?
Well, I went from someone who believed that we could work together as a team, worked with the Democrats inside of Congress to move things in the right direction. I know all about compromise. I mean, I taught team building as a professional. I did strategic planning with companies. I know there's got to be give and take, but what I've come to find out is that the whole bent here in Washington is towards more spending. It's an addiction. And I realized the only way I could change Washington was to change the people who were here. And that made me very unpopular as I endorsed opponents against sitting senators who were Republicans, like Arlen Specter. I endorsed Pat Toomey. And when the party picked Charlie Crist in Florida, I went down and tried to raise money for Marco Rubio. And all I did is set up a website called Senate Conservatives Fund. The address, by the way, is SenateConservatives.com, and started putting these candidates on there. And it allowed people in California to help a conservative in Florida. We raised over $9 million. The average contribution was $45 from average Americans who wanted to do their part to change things. So what changed is, first of all, I lost some friendships, and it was personally pretty isolating. But I did pick up a lot of friends outside of Washington who wanted to be part of a team to change things, and we did. And that's the point of the book, is to reinforce what people have done and encourage others to join us. The power has shifted from Washington back in the hands of the American people, and we need to recognize that and use it to turn things around.
Well, I thank you very much for taking your time to speak with us, answering our questions. We're going to be doing a segment later, Senator, about the constitutional question that's come up this week. I know you're familiar with it, the question about the 14th Amendment, and you will have laid the groundwork for that conversation by answering our questions in this segment. And I thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much for a very thoughtful interview. I appreciate it.
Jim DeMint has been senator from South Carolina since 2004. His latest book is The Great Awakening, 2 years that changed America, Washington, and me. It is out now. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. Up next, the autism debate gets more complicated as new studies point to serious environmental factors. Stay tuned.